Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. I am a PGY1 resident. Welcome to the 47th episode of the Divine Intervention Podcasts. I'm going to continue with our review of neurology for the clerkship. So let's begin. Slide number one, a student in a lab is unknowingly touching a lighted Bunsen burner in the chemistry lab until his hand is pulled away by the TA. Physical exam is notable for loss of pain and temperature sensation in the upper extremities bilaterally and mild hand muscle weakness. What's your diagnosis, right? So this is obviously a syringomyelia, right? So this is pain and temperature loss in a cape-like distribution. And the pathophysiology basically involves an obstruction in the spinal cord of the central canal. So when you obstruct that central canal, you then have like a cystic expansion of the central canal above it. And with that cystic expansion, you can basically begin to compress on the anterior white commissure. If you compress on the anterior white commissure, you basically knock out the spinothalamic tracts bilaterally, right? So, because remember, the spinothalamic tract, after it, you have the first synapse, like through the tract of Lissauer, and then you synapse in the posterior horn of the spinal cord. You then ultimately bring fibers that cross in the anterior white commissure before it ascends contralaterally in the lateral brainstem. So if you have expansion of the central canal, you'll damage the anterior white commissure, you'll knock out your spinothalamic tract. So bye-bye pain, temperature, and pain prick sensation bilaterally. And then the mild hand muscle weakness. Basically, the thing that happens is, as time goes on, if the compression like worsens, and you extend beyond the anterior white commissure, then you begin to damage the ventral horn of the spinal cord, right? And the thing is, the muscles that control your upper extremities, at least the lower motor neurons that control your upper extremities, they are found very relatively close to the anterior white commissure. So you begin to have like hand muscle weakness. And because this is a spinal cord pathology, you do actually make the diagnosis with MR imaging. So you use an MRI and you can make the diagnosis that way. So next slide, nuchal rigidity in a recent immigrant presenting with hemoptysis and high fevers. There is marked enhancement at the base of the brain. That's the high yield terminology here, at the base of the brain. So this should tell you that this is TB, right? And obviously for this, you'll want to do a lumbar puncture. And in the lumbar puncture, remember, TB is in fact a bacterial infection. But one of the big things you want to keep track of here is that the CSF studies will show predominance of lymphocytes, right? So it'll be a bacterial infection, but you'll see you have an elevated Y count, and the thing that will be elevated will be lymphocytes, and the CSF pressures will be, opening pressures will be high, okay? The protein content will be high as well because there's a lot of inflammation. The glucose level will be low. Okay, so really, like, TB meningitis is just like any other kind of bacterial meningitis. The only big difference is that instead of having a predominance of neutrophils, you have a predominance of lymphocytes. And in terms of your, so those are basically your findings on diagnostic testing, right? And I mean, you probably want to do like some kind of like culture of the CSF, right? Or you can do like the acid fast stain, right? So that's Zeal-Nielsen stain to identify TB. And in terms of treatment, right, you want to go ahead and give like the RIPE regimen, right? So like rifampin, remember that's an RNA polymerase inhibitor. You want to give isoniazid, remember that can cause heteroblastic anemia. You want to give pyrazinamide, remember that works pretty well in acidic tissue. And you want to give ethambutol, remember ethambutol can cause problems with colorblindness. So you want to keep track of those. And then you also want to give vitamin B6, right, pyridoxal phosphate, to prevent the peripheral neuropathy that's associated with isoniazid. Because remember, the enzyme that converts glutamate to GABA, GABA decarboxylase, uses vitamin B6 as a cofactor, and isoniazid depletes vitamin B6. So you have less of a cofactor in the conversion of glutamate to GABA. So if you have less GABA and more glutamate, you could potentially have seizures. And then in some cases, you'll see some texts that actually say to give steroids as well in the setting of TB meningitis. It keeps changing all the time. But for sure, bacterial meningitis, you do need to give a dose of dexamethasone, usually before you even give your first dose of antibiotics. Now, the way you differentiate meningitis from encephalitis is usually on exams. Encephalitis, those people tend to have more in the way of neurologic deficits. They don't usually have... they may not necessarily have nuchal rigidity. So just sort of keep that in mind. But I mean, encephalitis is inflammation of the brain itself. Meningitis is inflammation of the meninges, not necessarily the brain parenchyma. Now, next slide. The most common neurologic sequelae of meningitis in kids, that's actually hearing loss. And the top three causes of meningitis in neonates, right? So there's a simple mnemonic for this. It's known as GEL, G-E-L. So the G is for group B strep. Remember, group B strep causes essentially any notable infection in kids, at least in neonates. So the first 20 days of life. The E stands for E. coli. And then the L stands for listeria. In terms of treatment strategies, in general for a neonate, if they ask you what you would want to give empirically for suspected meningitis on tests, you want to go ahead and give ceftriaxone, right? So they will try to give you an answer that tempts you to choose ceftriaxone. Do not choose ceftriaxone because ceftriaxone can actually cause intrahepatic cholestasis in kids, so you don't want to do that. So basically give like the third gen baby cephalosporin. In that case, that will be ceftriaxone. So you give ceftriaxone, you give vancomycin, and you give ampicillin. The ampicillin helps you cover against listeria because that's like the drug that has been shown pretty consistently to cover listeria. An alternative regimen could be vancomycin and gentamicin, so sort of keep that in mind, but that's less common on tests. And then CSF studies in bacterial meningitis, right? So again, elevated white count, it'll be a predominance of neutrophils, protein will be high, right? Glucose will be low. If it's viral meningitis, things are relatively normal, right? So your opening pressure is not too high. You have a mildly elevated white count, but it will be primarily lymphocytes, right? You have low-ish glucose, right? So like low normal glucose. You have like high normal protein. Basically, things are like mostly normal in viral meningitis, where you see a ton of lymphocytes. And then for fungal meningitis, right, that's essentially like bacterial meningitis, right? So the thing is, if you notice, I'm trying to group things here for you. That's the thing. You don't want to just memorize things blindly. Try to group things. It's much easier to remember. Just basically remember the findings in bacterial meningitis and then remember that it's not neutrophils that are elevated. It's lymphocytes. And that's all you need to remember. Now, CSF studies in a patient with symmetric ascending paralysis after a recent diarrheal infection, right? So a bloody diarrheal infection, right? So hopefully with the symmetric ascending paralysis, you're thinking about Guillain-Barré syndrome, right? So this person potentially had a Campylobacter infection, and Campylobacter does cause bloody diarrhea. It's associated with Guillain-Barré syndrome, right? So that Guillain-Barré syndrome, right? You have like symmetric ascending paralysis. And the big thing I just wanted to point out here is the CSF finding of albuminocytologic dissociation. It's a classic finding in Guillain-Barré syndrome. And one other thing you also want to keep track of on this slide, right? So the question here says CSF studies in a 30-year-old female with an afferent papillary defect and other neurologic deficits, right? So this patient has multiple sclerosis. And in multiple sclerosis, right, the thing is you'll find something known as oligoclonal bands on CSF studies. So that's one thing you want to keep in mind, oligoclonal bands. Although really the way that MS is diagnosed is with it's a radiologic diagnosis, is diagnosed with an MRI. And just to, I guess, add a little more context with the albuminocytologic dissociation is, the thing is, if you notice, when we talked about the CSF studies in meningitis, right, for like bacteria, for example, I said, oh, the protein will be high and the white cell count will be high. The thing is, usually, when the white cell count goes up, the protein content goes up. That's usually the trend, okay? But if you look at a person's CSF study and you're like, wait, the protein amount is really high, but the white cell count is almost non-existent. There's no agreement between the white cell count and the total protein content, right? That concept is known as albuminocytologic dissociation. There is no agreement between the number of white cells you're seeing and the very elevated number of proteins you're seeing in the CSF. That is a pathognomonic finding on exams with Guillain-Barré syndrome. And then if you see CSF with a ton of red cells, right, you're thinking about herpes, right? HSV encephalitis. Remember, that classically affects the temporal lobes. Although if you see like 5,000 red cells in a patient CSF and they present with like nuchal rigidity and severe headache, you probably want to think more about a subarachnoid hemorrhage as against meningitis. Now, next slide, general treatment cocktail for bacterial meningitis, right? So just remember CVS, like the pharmacy, right? So the C for ceftriaxone, okay? You want to cover Neisseria meningitidis with that, the V for vancomycin, and then the S for steroids, okay? You want to give dexamethasone to reduce the morbidity and mortality associated with the inflammation. And if you're dealing with the elderly, you generally want to add ampicillin, right? So like the elderly, people that are immunocompromised, people that are super young, you want to go ahead and add ampicillin because that will cover Listeria, because Listeria is almost 100% fatal if it's not treated. And again, I've sort of repeated this on the previous slide, right? So like CSF studies with normal glucose, slightly elevated protein, and a lymphocytic pleocytosis, that's a viral meningitis, right? And then HSV meningitis or encephalitis, right, will show like enhancement in the temporal lobes of the brain. That's like the big buzzword you want to remember. Now, next slide says a 25-year-old male presents with a temperature of 103, severe headache, and a two-day history of profound lower extremity muscle weakness. He was recently treated for otitis media. So this is a high yield triad to be aware of. In this Q-STEM, the triad you want to sort of like lock down in your mind is fever, headache, and neurologic deficits. I'll repeat it again. Fever, headache, and neurologic deficits. Okay. Fever, headache, neurologic deficits. That is a brain abscess. That is the classic triad of a brain abscess. And usually in the Q-STEM on NBMEs, they'll be very careful to tell you that the patient does not have nuchal rigidity. Okay, so that's the triad for a brain abscess. Now, the way you make the diagnosis, right, is you do an MRI. An MRI shows a brain abscess really well. And you basically treat it the same way you treat meningitis. But it's just some key considerations to keep in mind is you usually try to incise and drain, like you're usually trying to drain the abscess, that's one. And then the second thing you try to do is you also give steroids, especially if the abscess is causing like compressive symptoms. You want to give steroids to decrease the swelling so that the patient does not herniate and die. And then the bug again, meningitis, MRI enhancement at the base of the brain, that's TB. You treat it with the right regimen and vitamin B6. Now, next slide, a 35-year-old zoologist is brought to the ED by ambulance after becoming unresponsive at home. He studies cave-dwelling animals, so I don't know, maybe bats, who knows. Over the past 2 weeks, he has resisted attempts by his parents to give him water or get him to the shower. That's bad news right there. This is rabies, right? This is rabies. And really, the way you would have prevented this is assuming he knew when he was bit by like a bat or whatever organism that was carrying the rabies virus, would have given him like the rabies immune globulin. And would have given him the rabies vaccine. And actually, one bizarre thing that may show up on an exam out of the blue that I feel like will stump a lot of people is the fact that you give the rabies vaccine and the rabies immune globulin at two different spots. You do not give them at the same spot to a human being because the immune globulin will just bind up the vaccine and then the vaccine will basically not mount an immune response. So you don't want to do that. So you give them at two different sites. And the pathognomonic histologic finding, right, those are Negri bodies. Negri bodies, they're like pink eosinophilic bodies that you'll find in neurons, pathognomonic for rabies. Now, next slide, bilateral acoustic neuromas, right? So the syndromic association, hopefully you're thinking about NF2, right? I talked about NF1 in the previous podcast. So NF2, neurofibromatosis type 2, okay? And again, it's a neurocutaneous disorder. This principle doesn't always work, but it works pretty well for the most part on NBMEs is most neurocutaneous disorders are inherited in an autosomal dominant fashion. Okay, and the gene product is Merlin. Okay, and the mutation is in chromosome 22. Okay, so just sort of keep that in mind. So chromosome 22, Merlin, autosomal dominant inheritance, NF2, classically associated with bilateral acoustic neuromas. Some people also call them vestibular schwannomas. And then the involved cranial nerve is cranial nerve 8. Okay, so that's why they have problems with like hearing and stuff like that. And remember that this tumor, I mentioned this in the previous podcast, these tumors classically arise at the cerebellopontine angle. Okay, they arise at the CP angle. They are the most common tumors that arise at the cerebellopontine angle, right? So basically, like, it's sort of like a junction between the cerebellum and the pons. Remember, the second most common tumor that arises at the CP angle is a meningioma. Remember, those are associated with sarcoma bodies on histology. And then the diagnostic testing, again, because this is a brain CNS problem, you make the diagnosis best with an MRI. Okay, next question. So port wine stain plus glaucoma plus seizures plus intellectual disability plus tram track CT calcifications. And I'll show you this picture of this beautiful baby with one side of his face red. Okay, this is a Sturge-Weber syndrome. Okay. Very high yield to know that this is actually not a heritable disease. It's actually something that arises sporadically. And really the thing that happens is it arises from an activating mutation in a gene known as GNAQ. So G as in Godfrey, N as in Nancy, A as in Apple, Q as in quality. Okay. So it's an activating mutation. So it's something that's sporadic. So it's not something that's actually, it's like a somatic mutation, if you may. It's basically like an issue that arises in the development of like mesoderm and I believe ectoderm. So these kids, they tend to have like intellectual disability. If you do imaging of the brain, you'll see like tram track calcifications. So you see like tram track calcifications. You'll see they may have like some weird like malformations in the brain, and it's usually ipsilateral to the port wine stain, which is what we see grossly in this child. So next question, restless leg syndrome, right? So you should not take your neurology shelf without knowing about restless leg syndrome, right? Like, it's one of those things you can pretty much guarantee that you'll find on most neurology exams, even step 2, step 3, and even step 1, right? So restless leg syndrome, the classic presentation is, it's almost always in a woman on tests, but it could be in a man, but classically it's in a woman. And they'll tell you that she has trouble sleeping, right? Because she feels like something moving in her leg or something weird. Basically like some weird leg sensation that's worsened when the patient goes to bed. Think about restless leg syndrome. And the demographic, again, classically it's in women. And the associated CBC anomaly, it actually has a weird association with iron deficiency anemia. So one thing you actually do in the workup of restless leg syndrome is actually to get a ferritin level, just to make sure that they don't have some kind of iron deficiency anemia gain going. And then in terms of treatment, you classically treat this with a dopamine agonist, right? So you can use drugs like pramipexol or ropinirole. So pramipexol and ropinirole are dopamine receptor agonists. Alternatively, you can actually give a barbiturate. There's one known as primidone. And believe it or not, that is fairly commonly tested. Primidone is a barbiturate that can be used to treat restless legs syndrome. Now, final question, carpal tunnel syndrome, right? So the classic presentation is they'll describe a patient that has trouble with their first 3.5 digits, right? So like the thumb, the index finger, the middle finger, and one half of the ring finger. Okay, and they'll tell you that they've lost sensation on the palmar aspect of the 3.5 digits. Remember, that is median nerve territory. Remember, the radial nerve actually does the dorsum, right? So like basically like the non-palm part of your hand, right? So the dorsum of the hand for the first 3.5 digits is done by radial nerve. So if a person has carpal tunnel syndrome, which is a median nerve palsy, they won't have any issues with those. Okay, so definitely keep that in mind. And then they may tell you that they have like atrophy of the thinner muscles, right? So thinner refers to your thumb. So if you have thinner muscle atrophy, think about carpal tunnel syndrome. Okay, and the classic patient population, right? So the thing is, I mean, carpal tunnel can arise in people that like sort of overuse their hands, right? So if you're like a person that furiously types on a keyboard all the time, you can get carpal tunnel with that. But carpal tunnel can actually be a presentation of rheumatoid arthritis, right? It can actually be a presentation of pregnancy, right? And it can also be a presentation of hypothyroidism. So basically anything that causes edema, like generalized edema, right? That can trigger carpal tunnel syndromes. Now, The physical exam maneuvers that you can use to elicit symptoms, there's actually a nice mnemonic that I use to remember these. So there's two, right? So there's a TINEL sign and then there's a Phelan sign. So remember the T in TINEL for teen tapping. So if you sort of tap over the carpal tunnel, you elicit symptoms. And then the other one is the Phelan sign. Think of Phelan like flexing. Okay, so the Phelan sign is when you flex the wrists bilaterally. Tell the patient to hold that position for like 60 seconds. If you reproduce their carpal tunnel symptoms like the pain and paresthesias in the median nerve distribution, that confirms your diagnosis. And really, it's something that's for the most part diagnosed clinically. And it is super, super, super high yield to know the stepwise management of carpal tunnel syndrome. So the first thing you do is a wrist splint. Okay, you basically keep the hand in a neutral position. Okay, if that doesn't work, your next step on exams is to jump to an NSAID, right? So like ibuprofen, naproxen, stuff like that. If an NSAID does not work, the next thing you want to jump to on test is to inject steroids into the carpal tunnel. Okay, now if that does not work, then you go for the nuclear option. The nuclear option is to cut the carpal tunnel. Okay, so high yield to know this. Wrist splint for starters, that doesn't work. NSAIDs, that doesn't work. Inject steroids into the carpal tunnel, that doesn't work. Proceed to cutting the carpal tunnel. But the thing is, before you chop up a person's carpal tunnel, you most certainly want to do a nerve conduction study. You just want to confirm that you have a median neuropathy before cutting that carpal tunnel. So very high yield to know those. And that is where I'm going to stop. I really hope you get something out of this. I will come up with our next episode, hopefully sometime this weekend. So have a great rest of the day and God bless. I'll see you next time.